This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
So welcome to the 29th Annual Writer Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Ben Cater, Director of the Honors Program, and with us this evening is Paulette Giles, poet, memoirist, and author of several novels, including Enemy Women, The Color of Lightning, News of the World, which in 2016 was nominated for a National Book Award, and her most recent, Chenevelle. Paulette Giles, welcome to the Writer Symposium.
Thank you.
So in getting ready for tonight's conversation, I've had the pleasure of getting familiar with your background. And my goodness, you've had a very adventurous life all throughout the West. You were born in Missouri. You attended the university there, graduating with a degree in Romance Languages. You worked for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, helping to establish a radio station in native languages for the tribes of Northern Ontario and Quebec. I learned that you lived in a log cabin.
Yes.
This is true.
Yes.
All right. You worked for a short time as a journalist for an Indian language newspaper, writing about forest fires, crimes of passion, and very serious bush plane accidents.
Yeah.
All right. You published a book of poetry in 1973, followed by more poetry while in Canada in the 1980s. Winning several awards, including the prestigious Governor General's Award in 1984. In the late 80s, you started writing novels. You moved to Texas, then to Mexico, and then back to Texas.
Yeah.
Several years ago, News of the World, another one of your novels, was turned into a blockbuster film starring Tom Hanks. You play the Irish tin whistle in a band currently. Am I missing anything?
No, not so far.
All right. Well, very adventurous. Now, central to your adventures has been writing and language. I'm curious why you've devoted your professional life to words and storytelling as opposed to other art forms like music.
Well, how do they relate is what you're asking me.
Say it again.
You're asking me how they relate.
Well, why have you devoted so much of your time to the written word, to storytelling in particular?
Yeah. Well, before I say anything else, I will say thank you to Dean Nelson and the Writers Symposium by the Sea for having me, mm-hmm. and to Ben mm-hmm. here, and to Ashley Montaño for with the graduate students mm-hmm. student program. Mm-hmm. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. It's been a great trip. And meeting wonderful people. And to answer your question, I think when I was in the far north, working in the far north, I was in my late 20s and on through my 30s. I spent quite a few years there. And poetry was a short form that you could carry with you anywhere. Mm-hmm. And my poems just kind of kept getting longer and longer. So I thought, why not write a book? And then I started in that enterprise. And that, of course, is far more demanding and takes much, much more time than writing poems. And when I won the Governor General's Award, I had my manuscript, before the manuscript got in book form, a lot of the bush plane crashes were so bad that I would not travel with that manuscript. I used to leave it with friends, directions as to where it would go. So that was an exciting time, and that was when I was far more agile than I am at present, and I enjoyed it. I loved it. I loved every minute of being in the North, and the temperatures were extreme, but I never wrote any novels about that. My heart lay in the West, I suppose. So when I left the North, I married a Texan, which is why I moved to Texas. And then I simply had more time for the much, much longer spaces needed to put together a book, but it took me 10 years to write Enemy Women.
Yeah.
The following books would be only maybe 2 years, 3 years at the most, 2 years, I would say. So it just depends on how much time you have, mm-hmm. much disposable time.
Your novels, each one of them has a very compelling story, a different set of characters. Sometimes they'll reappear in different stories, but they really are their own animals. A common thread, though, throughout all the stories is the American West during and after the Civil War period.
Yeah.
And I'm curious what you find so compelling about this time and place as a setting.
Well, in some ways, as I said, it took me 10 years to write Enemy Women. And I come from a large family. I got 25 first cousins. That's just on my dad's side. And so one of those cousins was a legislative aide in Washington, D.C., and I forgot the name of the person he was a legislative aide to, but he was researching our family history. We were trying to find out what happened to our great-great-grandfather. He disappeared during the Civil War. And he had been a justice of the peace. He was a man who helped to found Carter County. He taught the common school. And people like that generally leave a paper trail somewhere. Yeah. And we could not, the last entry we had on him was in 1861 when he married a young couple in January. January is traditional Southern time mm-hmm. for getting married because the candles don't melt in the July heat. So that's a true story. So, and we could not find out what happened to him. And so I began to research that period. I began to do my own. As I said, people who write historical novels depend on historians to give us some material, because you can't do everything,
right?
You can't write a novel and, you know, do all the historical research. But I had to do a lot of original research in courthouses looking for whatever to my grandfather, my great-great-grandfather. And with all that material, I became fascinated with that period and what happened to my people when they lived through it, which was a fratricidal war, if there ever was one, in that area. And then I began to think, I'm going to make a novel out of this. The one really exciting thing I found, which would lend itself to a story, was that they were imprisoning a lot of women.
Mm-hmm.
Women were being imprisoned in great numbers in Missouri at that time. So a novel grew out of that. And I had all my material. I had, you know, when you're doing historical research, you have to pay attention to coinage and whether federal dollars were, you know, issued at that time, which they were for 25 cents. It wasn't a dollar, it was a federal bill for 25 cents. This was one of the first federal bills put out. You know, what kind of shoes people wore? People did not have left and right shoes until after the Civil War. You just wore them out until they fit your feet, and then you switched feet, then they got really raggedy. So I had all my material done, and I loved the period. It was fascinating to me. It was personal to me. So then I had them traveling down to Texas. I was going to write a sequel to Enemy Women and have Adair and the Major, after they married, moving into North Texas. And then I started looking at North Texas. Then I ran into this wonderful character. It was the only true historical character I've ever written about. And that was Britt Johnson, who was a black frontiersman. And he was a remarkable person. So I thought, and why hasn't anybody ever written about this guy? So I did. I wrote a book about him. And in that book, am I going on too long? Do you have any
No, questions? Go ahead. This is wonderful.
I don't want to.
A very thorough response.
Okay. So at any rate, as a novelist, you look for ways to impart information to your readers without huge lumps of it coming at them. That's called an information dump. And I didn't want to do an information dump, but I wanted Britt to become aware of the fact that the 13th and 14th Amendments had been passed and that he could vote. And so I was thinking how to do that without because I didn't think he would have been able to read and write. In fact, I know he didn't because he signed his name with an X on some document. I forget which one. So I was looking around for a way to get that information to the reader. At any rate, I was having dinner with my friends, June and Wayne Chisholm, who are ranchers that moved down to the hill country where I live now. And Wayne happened to mention that his great-grandfather had gone around doing readings out of newspapers for various towns to bring them the news. And he would choose juicy pieces of news that they couldn't have gotten otherwise, like from the Philadelphia Inquirer, which would reprint an article from the London Times about Arctic exploration, or the first baseball game, or the first woman lawyer to be admitted to the bar, and these wonderful pieces of just bits and pieces. And so I said, Wayne, that's a great character. Can I have him? I want him. And he said, take him. He's dead. You know, he's not going to object. So he's all yours. So, and that was Captain Kidd. And his name was Kidd. And they called him Captain Kidd. But his name is Cornelius Aloysius Kidd. And I picked a simpler name for my character. So I had him come to town and read from a newspaper, which gave the information that the 13th and 14th Amendments had been passed, with Britt standing at the back of the audience listening, and that's how he got the information. And that's how I avoided an information dump.
So thank you very much.
You're welcome.
So you clearly have a historical cast in mind and you enjoy research. I'm curious, we're all better off that you went into novel writing, but why didn't you go into history?
I'm a novelist. I've been a novelist since I was 11, when I wrote my own book and did little pictures and tied it all together into a binder. And I said, I did a book. So, I mean, it's just...
You knew from an early age you wanted to write.
Yes, okay. Absolutely.
Well, let's talk about Chenevil.
Okay.
It's a very complicated book. As I read it, I was trying to figure out, okay, what is this really about? And it's about a number of things. It's a revenge tale.
Yeah.
There's romantic qualities to it. It's a historical novel, but it also has these components of an epic. Can you provide us a brief summary of the basic plot?
Yes, it's a revenge tale. And it's a revenge tale which uses a very common, it uses an opening which has been used off and on throughout history, the history of novels, history of literature, which is that your protagonist, your main character, wakes up someplace and he or she does not know where they are, and they don't remember their own name, and they don't know who these people are who are surrounding them, and that can take many, many different forms. And basically that is so... deeply touches us so deeply because this is what happens when we're born. We don't know who we are. We don't know what our name is. We don't know who these people are who are surrounding us, except our mother, except this one person. So it's, in a way, it's a kind of birth story, a genesis story. And so that's how it opens. Our hero has been an officer in the Civil War, an officer for the Union. And he suffers a very serious head wound. And so we're with him when he wakes up at a hospital, a field hospital in Virginia, and he doesn't know where he is. And it takes a while before he knows what his name is. Then he slowly begins to recover his self bit by bit. He gathers himself together. He goes through his memories the way you would go to a shelf of forgotten manuscripts. Somewhere in here is my name, somewhere in here is my history, somewhere in here is where I was born or where I'm from and why I'm here. And then he discovers that his beloved sister and her husband and their baby have been murdered. And so he is determined to set out and find the killer. And he's from that part of the country had a very old French sub layer of French villages and settlement before the Anglos came. I'm related to those people. That's why my first name is Paulette. and he's recovering two languages. He's recovering country French, which is like Cajun French, and he's recovering his own language to describe things and think about where they are. And so he is determined to learn to ride a horse, shoot a gun, be able to read and write again, because he doesn't see writing like you and I see writing. He sees writing as somehow the letters are higher than the plane on the white page, and he's trying to get the letters to fit back on the page again. And he says, when I recover this, I'm going to find the killer, and he will come to his just reward.
Mm-hmm. Your previous stories, News of the World, for instance, certainly dealt with hardship, with the real gritty suffering that people experienced in the 19th century West. Chenevil seems to deal with a different type of human despair. You call it radical evil. Why did you want to entertain this as a core part of the plot?
Of radical evil, yes. It's something that he has to deal with. He's born and raised a Catholic, which I think my ancestors were all born and raised Catholic. And so the rituals of the church then would somehow give him a structure with which to deal with the thought of radical evil. And it's there, and it's demonic. I think we've lost that word demon and devil and demonic. Because it seems to, I mean, it's a good handle. It's a good language handle to use for people who are, in fact, serial killers and enjoy killing. They just seem to be born that way. I don't know why. I have no answer for myself, but I know I think the first task is to say that, yes, they exist.
Mm-hmm. In the 19th century West, in fact, one of the alluring things about it is that there is so much open space relative to, say, the urbane East, that people have a degree of freedom to do as they please. But because of a whole bunch of things, perhaps their innate psychological or spiritual tendencies to be selfish, lawlessness could reign. And so honor really matters, because honor is what gets things done. When you focus on the West and Chenevil, you do entertain certain conventions of the Western genre, most notably freedom you deal with. You also focus on the plain setting, the solitary man on a horse, the struggle for survival in a harsh and unforgiving landscape. But there's this other sort of genre or literary tradition that seems to be, I don't know, brought into the mix, and that's more of an ancient plot line. It has like a mythic or a dreamlike quality to the story. Honestly, when I read Chenevil, I was thinking of the epic poem, The Odyssey, or Macbeth.
No.
Would that be fair to say, that it kind of melds the two, a Western genre and more of like an ancient plot line?
Yeah, the revenge drama is of course, as old as the Odyssey. We see Odysseus coming home and slaughtering all of the suitors that had been trying to rob him of his wealth, and only he could draw that bow. I think that's an important part in there. A lot of people miss it or skip over it, but it's mentioned several times that he gets his bow back. It's there at the house, and only he can draw it. None of the suitors could have drawn it. Mm-hmm. They're not strong enough. So we're saying this is a very strong man, and I think maybe you're saying interior strength as well. He has to recover his family's honor, mm-hmm, as well, because he's been treated as if he were nothing but a weak thing that anybody could take away: his wife, his child, his wealth, his the things that he has worked for. So he's got to recover both of those, and his interior strength is the ability to draw that bow. So there's a lot of symbolism in that bow.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you were asking about lawlessness. And in a lawless area, of course, people have to depend on honor, and they have to be very sensitive about another person and be able to second guess just what kind of person they're dealing with. Mm-hmm. And as far as iconic images, yeah, I had a lot of fun with iconic images and writing. You know, I think in The Hero's Journey, who wrote that? Campbell? Is that Campbell? At any rate, the hero always has animal companions. He always has an animal companion and a sidekick. Mm-hmm. So he ends up with Lemuel, the hospital steward, and he ends up with a dog and a horse. So they all had animal companions. So if you look at any hero story, that just seems to happen naturally. And one place I discovered it, and this may surprise you, was in The Old Man and the Sea. And it's not the marlin. If you remember that he dreams repeatedly about the lions on the coast of Africa, those are his animal companions to this hero. So they always end up with them, whether it's a dog, cat, turtle, whatever, not a turtle.
Going back to the Western as a genre, and maybe a core theme throughout it is freedom to act in particularly good ways or particularly evil ways. One thing that I found interesting in the book is that there's a lot of freedom for John. He's free to pursue Dodd, who is the antagonist. He's free to pursue a type of justice on behalf of his sister. And yet at the same time, he sort of runs into what I interpreted as a type of destiny, a type of fate, perhaps providence in the Judeo-Christian tradition. And there was a couple quotations here that I thought were very telling of this issue of fate or destiny. I'd like to read them. The first one is, he turned his head up to the evening sky and saw Orion rising in the east, faithful and perfect in his architecture of light. He had always liked that constellation, the warrior, the belt of stars, a sword at his side. And so he went down toward Edward's station, all his secrets walking along beside him like greyhounds. And the constellation seemed to walk with him as well, treading this inevitable path, the great stars with their enormous feet. Later on in the story you write, and I think this is John speaking to the Marshal Giddens, God let me live through the war so I could find this man. I know it. That's what I'm here for. That's why I'm alive. She and her family were shot to death, and when I learned of it, I knew there had to be an accounting. I guess my question is, was it hard for you when you were writing the story to thread the needle and on the one hand balance the sort of like Western theme of freedom while at the same time embracing this ancient plot line of there is a destiny, maybe there are some other cosmic forces at work that have set my path up before me?
Well, I think the two have always run side by side, the freedom to carry out what seems to be not orders from on high, but a call of destiny, I guess you could call it. They're free to do that. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people are not always free to do that. And they know what the right thing to do is, but they find themselves incapable of it because of poverty or because of physical limitations or whatever. So I think the two have always run parallel. They've run side by side, it seems to me. Mm-hmm. And that symbol of Orion and the warrior, in fact, Orion's up in the sky now, so don't miss him because he'd be gone during the summer, so catch him before he goes, is very powerful. And I think it goes back to the earliest, our earliest times, the Paleolithic times, because it's so clearly a man with a belt and a star and his sword and the head of, and Taros is right beside him. He's got Taros with the head and his dog, mm-hmm. Canis, mm-hmm. is with him as well, his animal companion. So I think having those two things run parallel depends on the person's capability of carrying it out. He's free to carry it out because he's strong enough. Mm-hmm. And he's free. I mean, he's not got financial obligations. So the two run on side by side, it seems to be.
Chenevil has already sold well. It was released, I believe, last September. It sold very well. And it, like all of your books, I mean, these are blockbuster books. They're very well received. They seem to resonate with us modern folks. But given the ancient, I guess, proclivities of the plot line, and to the extent that we really appreciate those ancient plot lines, does that actually make us modern people really ancient in our sensitivities?
Yes.
We're ancient people. Okay, this is terrific. Well, it does make me wonder about the nature of time. It seems like it's a wonder. It's like the past actually continues to speak to us.
Yes, of course it does. I mean, without it, I mean, we're not simply mechanical or digital people. This is very much within us that, and people say that human intelligence was created by our social ability to relate socially more efficiently than the Neanderthals, for instance, who didn't care. Apparently, they did not care for their young and for their old people as we do, as we're supposed to do. So, of course, it's going to stay with us no matter what.
Let's take some time to talk about your characters. Where did they come from? Chenevelle is a historical novel. Are they based on real people?
The murder of his sister and husband and the baby actually happened. Only it was three children that were shot to death. And this is in southeast Missouri, where I come from. And when I learned about this, it had never been pursued. Nobody had ever found out who did it. And as far as I can tell, there was never any attempt to find out who. It was a Patterson family in Bullinger County. And their bodies were thrown into a spring. And that always bothered me that such a terrible crime, shooting babies. I mean, you know, that's going over the limit there. That's over the top, and that it had never been pursued. So, that's what really started Chenevelle, which was to find somebody to avenge that murder, even if it's in fiction, to put things right. So my cousin and I, one of my cousins, one of my many, many first cousins, and I found our way to the spring where their house had been. It had been burnt. And they buried all six of them there. And some of the gravestones are, in the Ozarks, people didn't put up gravestones so much as they heaped rocks up. And so you could still see some of the graves. And we found the spring where the bodies were thrown. So, yes, it really bothered me, and it's still not, nobody's ever solved that murder. And that was very unusual during the Civil War. I mean, during the Civil War, it was terrible in southeastern Missouri, but it was men killing other men, armed men staying up. I mean, it was a fair fight, more or less, and people did not shoot women and children. It's the only instance I've ever heard of, but it remains unsolved to this day, so.
John, your main character, is a very complicated individual. He's possessed by rage, suspicion, at times skepticism, and understandably so. But he's also merciful, and he's very considerate of others, particularly the least of these. If you were to go down the list, that would include a former soldier having a nightmare, likely struggling with PTSD. He comforts him. He's very sympathetic to young wives in very challenging marriages. He's very considerate of orphaned kids. He leaves $100 at an orphanage for a young girl. He's very concerned about the mistreatment of animals. I think we all probably know that injustice can at times harden people. In John's case, I'm curious, why doesn't the murder of his sister turn him into a cynic? Yeah, why doesn't it just harden him? Where does he get this compassion and this tenderness still? Why does he maintain his humanity?
I think because he's an emotionally intelligent person. There's emotional intelligence, and then there's sort of book intelligence or test intelligence. But there's a lot of people who are just born with an emotional intelligence. Mm-hmm. And I try to get that across to people by a brief description of his parents, his mother was a bit of a snob, but she was a rational person. And his dad is a very mild, very kind person. And I often think John growing up he took after his mother's people in his looks. He's very tall, he's very fair. And his dad is typically French, dark hair, dark eyes, French from that area. So I gave him a good parental background and a good religious upbringing, just standard, you know, sure. Go to church every Sunday, go home, you know, just mm-hmm. get your duty done. But it's there, and so So from his family, he developed an emotional intelligence. But he's also a very aggressive man. You know, he's a very aggressive man, and he's determined to get his way, whatever his way is, whatever needs to be done, he's willing to do it. He gets in a couple of really pretty lethal fights and fights his way out of it, and he feels great about it. So.
He seems to be very interested in perhaps the healing power of storytelling and song. You have a couple instances in which he references these folk tales that he grew up with. And I'm wondering, would you be willing actually to read a particular section in which he references Tijan? I think I have it here. Let's see, where is it? Thank you.
He laughed despite himself. It's like that Tijan story, he said aloud. When Tijan ends up being followed by all the animals, viens, si tu veux, marche, mais marche derrière. His father's face, that means, okay, come along if you want, but you have to walk behind me, walk in line behind me. So all the animals begin to follow Tijan to the giant's house. It's an old story. His father's face came to him in a firelit image, spinning out the story. It was all so logical, and a neatly tied up ending was for heartening a person. That's what they were for, these tales, because their small heroes never died at the end. But they did not live either, except in the telling of the tale. And so they must be retold without end. The gift of the grateful dead.
Thank you very much. Here you seem to be saying that stories don't die to the extent that we continue to tell them. Yeah. Also that, you know, art seems to imitate life, but maybe another point that you try to make is that we're actually shaped by the stories we tell. And frankly, we're probably shaped by the stories we choose not to tell. Is that what you're trying to say here?
No, I think when I think of John, I think of his mind as having been formed by someone who is willing to sit down with him and tell him a story. Mm-hmm. And the story has a sort of happy ending. It's like to hearten a person. And when kids hear those stories from a very young age, of Tijan, who was clever. Even though he was small, mm-hmm. he used his brains, and he made his way through the world, and he's a very clever young guy. And these stories, when we tell our children these stories, and they listen very carefully, because children are always looking for, how do I function in this world? What do I do if this happens? What do I do if that happens? And if you tell them these stories that have a coherent, they cohere somehow. You're telling them there is coherence in the world. Mm-hmm. There's logic in the world. And there's happy endings in the world. Mm-hmm. And I think that with that kind of background was part of his growing up and partly made his character.
John struggles with memory. It's very evident in the story. Both remembering and really having a sense of what to do with his memories. There's a terrific passage that I'd like to read. His memory had returned in fragments, unbidden and intensely real. His sister, a place in his mind, kindness and laughter, curled brown hair and a French habit of clapping her hands together when she was laughing and laughing herself into near hysteria when she held a pear out to her, when he held a pear out to her and said it looked like the backside of Aunt Pelagie. Ghosts of a memory, impressions. His brain had gone back to the basics, remembering and remembering. This is truly what we are to each other, a shape, a feeling, phantoms of love or threat or laughter, those who are lucid and speak in a strange old archaic French and smell of well-worn wool, of tobacco, of apples and wine. What makes you so interested in memory, in this aspect of consciousness?
I think I just ran into it after thinking about somebody with a head wound trying to recover memory and trying to piece things back together, mm-hmm. and how that would happen. So I read a lot about brain injuries and how people recovered memories in very strange ways. They would remember one thing but not another, or they could remember enormous amounts of music but be missing large chunks of language. Mm-hmm. So I found that really interesting and just started studying it. It's one of those things you go off on a side trail when you're researching. Yeah.
Both Western and epics are often driven by action. Was it hard to write a story that moves, that keeps our attention in that regard, but it also slows down for meditative reflection like this?
Yes, you have to balance the two, and as I was mentioning earlier to the poets group, you have to balance them. I really find it it makes a book interesting, and it carries the reader through. It carries me through. When you balance narrative summary with direct scenes, you have action scenes, and action scenes are hard because of what leads up to them and how you get out of them. How do you bring your character down from a hard fight? He had a very hard fight in a mule barn, if you'll recall, and how do you get him out of that? So I had him, he pretty well cleaned the clock of that guy. I mean, he left him for dead.
Right.
And so how does he get out of that? And John is very conscious of the fact he's been in war for 3 years. He's been fighting for 3 years and mm-hmm. His brain injury, and he knows he has to get out of it. And so I have him ride 20 miles in the dark to get back to Saint Genevieve, the little French village where he was staying. And it was a nighttime ride, and that calmed him down, and he waded a couple of streams and threw cold water in his face and did any number of things to get out of that fighting mentality.
Another character really vital to John's development is Aubrey Robertson, the Western Union telegraph operator.
Most people like that character.
He's angelic. In such a gloomy story at times, was it a relief to write about him?
Yes, it was. And it was a relief to get away from what you call a closed third.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in a third person, where you state absolutely with that person's point of view. Mm-hmm. That's called a closed third. Mm-hmm. And it can get a bit heavy at times. And it's nice to switch over to Aubrey's point of view and see John through Aubrey's eyes.
Right.
And Aubrey sees this giant, 6'3" guy appearing out of a snowstorm, armed to the teeth, and he's alone. He's this little English telegrapher that's stuck in Oklahoma, which to him is like Mars. And this guy is approaching out of a snowstorm, and mm-hmm. that was fun. It was fun to see John from another character's point of view.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think part of what makes him endearing is because he does represent such a contrast to John in terms of his physical stature, in terms of his, the fact that he's an English citizen, apparently visiting or in a part of the world that really he seems to have no business being in. But he's also a very interesting character, not simply endearing. He's interesting because he raises some really interesting issues. In the Judeo-Christian calendar, we're in the season of Lent, and perhaps for that reason, I'm thinking in terms of atonement. Aubrey is murdered. I'm sorry for the spoiler, but Aubrey is murdered. But after his mortal life comes to an end, he continues to enable John in his pursuit of righting a wrong. And so he seems to actually live beyond his mortal life in an atoning sort of way. One of the interesting things, though, is that John will actually take the baton and continue to do that, but he'll go in the opposite direction. You point out that John is 33 years old, and straight from the Apostles' Creed, you say that he descends into hell. Just like the Christ, to deal with the sin of Lali's murder. And I guess I'm curious, were you consciously writing in terms of atonement at this point?
No, but I think stuff like that comes to you. If you're really committed to the writing and you're deeply engaged in it, all kinds of wonderful coincidences happen. All kinds of wonderful things happen. They're like gifts. But they're a gift, but you paid for it mm-hmm. by intense focus for long, long periods of time, and they just sort of happen. And Aubrey Robertson, My neighbor is this little English woman, and she's about my age, and she's Oriel Robertson. And she's always said things like, everybody tries to, fob tea off on me. I detest tea. I hate tea. But they keep pushing it on me because I'm English. And she says all kinds of stuff like that. So I said, one day I ran into her. They just live a quarter mile down the road. And I said, Oriel, I kind of used your character in a book, only I gave it to a guy and he gets murdered. And I later remember, I later heard her on the phone talking to friends of hers in English. She said, I'm in a book, but I get bumped off.
Dodd, the antagonist of the story, just really a terrible person. He kills without thought. He's cruel to everyone and everything he meets. I'm interested, as much as the reader can develop an understandable distaste for this character, why don't you write a chapter in which you recover his perspective that lets us into understanding why he is doing what he is doing?
I did. I wrote a chapter from his point of view and an interior monologue, because I know that it's very clear that the serial killers are people who are at the extreme end of narcissism. They're narcissists, malignant narcissists to the power of a million. And I wrote, I tried to get in his mind, which is hard to do. And it's I think it was C.S. Lewis that called it sort of demonic ventriloquism when you tried something like that. And I thought I would try it as a challenge. And I think it was successful. But my agent and my editor talked me into pulling that chapter out. So, and I stayed in his mind when he murdered another young boy. But the thing was, there was no buildup to it. Mm-hmm. There was no portions beforehand where you see Dodd by himself, or we see him in a third person or something, and it stuck out very badly. But for $20 extra, you can have the whole chapter.
I admit, towards the end of the book, I'm rooting for John to give Dodd his comeuppance. I'm curious why you deny us the satisfaction of reading that scene.
Because he would have ended up in Huntsville, in prison, which is Texas's federal prison for murderers and people of that sort. So then the story would have become, how could he stay out of prison? How could he avoid Giddens?
Well, and there seems to be a sort of a thematic coherence in the book, in the sense that while he's denied this, you also have a character early on in the story say very clearly that there is no justice in the world, that frankly, the things that should happen often don't happen. It's sort of an upside down sort of like moral universe that we live in at times.
Yes. He does not get his revenge, but revenge was taken, and inadvertently. And it happens at the end of Simon the Fiddler.
We're going down this sort of laundry list of characters. One actually was very surprising to me, and that was technology, specifically Morse code and telegraphy. Both of those things appear to develop a persona. They're not simply machines. I guess, first of all, where did your interest in Morse code come from?
My brother and I figured out Morse code when I was like 10 and he was 12, and we could communicate with each other, and our parents didn't know what we were talking about. We could do dots and dashes, and yeah, it was fun.
Okay.
It was lots of fun. So, and then, I just always was kind of interested in it, and it's astonishing appearance of a time when everything else was comparatively so primitive, and yet you could move words across 1,000 miles within 30 minutes. And how did people deal with this? See, Dodd doesn't understand the power of telegraphy, and that's how John is able to track him into Texas and on down. Military mainly had control of it, but he could still talk them, and Bell helps him.
Right.
And Victoria Rivas helps him. It's sort of love over the wires before they ever met. She's determined to help him because she was in love with Aubrey, who got murdered, and she wants to see him get as well.
That's right.
If John didn't get him, she was going to get him. But Don had no idea that this was possible, or he hadn't thought about it or something. So it was a whole new technology, astounding technology.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to read a couple sections that sort of indicate this sort of like personal quality of Morse code. The first one is, the telegraph poles hummed overhead, traveling above him, John. As he walked, they would not leave him alone, but continued on with their copper messages. Maybe the messages were about him. No, it was Bell above him in the singing wires, talking to somebody, receiving messages from somebody. Later on, you write, overhead, the telegraph wires whistled in the mild spring wind like flutes, and he wondered if she was speaking on them with her small boyish hand crackling with sparks. He would find a station somewhere and send her a message to ask if she would wait for him. Traditionally, we think of humanity and machines as being in like a master-servant relationship. Here it's different. It's more interdependent and symbiotic. How come?
Between.
Well, they're sort of almost like working in tandem for a common purpose.
Yes, yes. Well, the whole history of the of those wires were part of the history of the West. And so, yes, and people develop personal relationships over the wire. You know that. I guess most of you know that people who were sending telegraphic messages developed a certain hand that was just like handwriting. And an operator way down the line could be picking up messages, and we know who's sending it because of the particular quirks of that person's way of sending. And he recognizes her hand.
That's right.
After a while. It's a very quick hand, but it's very accurate because she's very careful to get everything just right, and she doesn't sacrifice anything for speed. So yes, it was very symbiotic between human beings and the wire. And he learned telegraphy during the war in Virginia. And I learned a lot of really interesting stuff about the wartime telegraphers, both Confederate and Union. Interesting.
That symbiotic nature makes me think that the brave new world of AI is not actually that new. I mean, we've sort of seen this already in the 19th century. I would like to turn briefly to talk about your writing. Your writing, it's been observed by many people, has a very wonderful poetic quality to it. It's lyrical, it's evocative, it's minutely realized, at times very profound. I'd like to read a couple passages. A memory far better. This is in reference to John. Vaulting off the side rails of the ferry on a summer day, coming up foaming, others hitting the water all around him, shouts, crawling up the muddy bank and stripping his clothes to hang them over the wharf side to dry. A good thing to remember this cold night. He floated in the milk-warm blood of nations, many nations. Of course, the river being the Mississippi. The Missouri River, I meant. And then secondly, he sat to rest upon a convenient shelving of stone and listened. What there was to listen to was deeply interesting. The silence was thoughtfully decided. It was punctuated like a musical score with dry leaving, falling in crisp little rustles, a distant hawk calling, something stepping with great care through the snow with pinpoint hooves, the continuous sounds of rushing water down in the steep valley of the little river. I guess the obvious question is how did you get so good at writing?
Thank you. I'll just accept a compliment because I don't know. Well, but when people start talking about writing a historical novel and ask me for advice, I say camp out for 2 weeks. Go without your phone and take matches and lanterns for light and camp out for 2 weeks so you can get a sense of how things are very different without electricity.
Yeah.
And, you know, there wasn't any light unless you carried it in your hands. My grandkids always remember this, that I took them to, my husband and I refurbished an old 1890 house in San Antonio in the historic district. And once I took them through the house carrying battery lanterns, and I said, this is how it was when this house was built. You did not have light in a room unless you walked into the room carrying mm-hmm. it in your hands. Mm-hmm. And it does wonderful things with shadows, mm-hmm. incredible stuff with shadows.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I tell people, camp out for 2 weeks, three if you can, on hiking, and then take notes.
Yeah, play acting.
Yeah.
Right. Now, are there writers you admire that you seek to imitate?
That I imitate?
Mm-hmm, that you try to? Do you take cues from particular colleagues in the field?
No, yes, for different reasons. Some people have a wonderful facility with plot, so mm-hmm. I pay attention to that. Other people have a good facility with different styles of writing. So yeah, lots of different authors.
Yeah. Are you working on anything right now?
Yeah, I'm working on some dystopian novels continuing off of Lighthouse Island. Yeah.
Chenevelle seems like it'd be a wonderful movie. Are there plans to turn it into a film?
God's ears.
I'm sorry?
From your lips to God's ears.
Do you have some parting words of wisdom for aspiring writers in the crowd?
Yes. Ask yourself which books you love the most, and which you reread, and reread two or three times, and you say, this is the most moving thing I've ever read. Ask yourself why you like it, and then begin to choose that book as a mentor, the author and the book as a mentor. Since you can't have a human mentor, a book mentor is just as good. Why do I like it? How does it move? When does it slow down? Where does it pick up? How does this person write action scenes? How does this person avoid action scenes? How do they develop characters? How long does a dialogue go on? Does it go on for a whole chapter? And do they maintain interest? And then does it go to their summary or description or what? But take that book that you love very much and look at the technical aspects of it. Yeah.
Paulette Giles.
Cheap.
Thank you for being with us at the Writer Symposium.
Thank you, Ben. Thank you for having me.
Welcome.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.